Independent Audit Committee was established by charter and receives audit reports and other information from the Denver Audit Office. The committee strives to bring greater clarity, transparency, and accountability to Denver's city government and its residents. It also produces the city's annual comprehensive financial report. This committee is chaired by Auditor Timothy M. O'Brien. And it starts right now.
Good morning. I'm going to call the May meeting of the Independent Audit Committee to order. Please call the roll, please.
Jack Blumenthal.
Here.
Lorraine Nath.
Here.
Leslie Mitchell.
Here.
Ed Schultz.
Here.
Frank Rowe.
Here.
Here. We do have a quorum.
Yes.
Yeah. Next item is approval of the April meeting minutes. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor? Any opposed? The minutes are approved. Okay, next is a follow-up audit report under our fleet management. Simon and Sean will present the audit report from the Department of Transportation. Would you like to introduce yourself and your colleagues?
Yeah, absolutely. Good morning. We are from the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure. I'm Cindy Patton. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the department, so I have a lot of the operating teams, maintenance teams, our budget office, performance office, and of course our fleet management division, who are with me here today, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
Brian Salazar, Donnie's fleet director.
Greetings. Bill Zolo, fleet management's resource center manager.
Michael Hugson, operation fleet manager.
Welcome. Any opening remarks you'd like to make?
I'll just start with a thank you to the team that we worked with. I think I said this last time we were here. It was a great experience. I don't say that every time we do an audit. Very much a partnership in helping us tell our story and working with us to dig deeper on the information that we had. You know, it's very forensic, this process. So we really, really appreciate that, and also really appreciate the kudos that we got at the end of the audit in the follow-up period. A former colleague who's since left, Jennifer, just heralded the team for being one of the most implemented audits of late, and we really are proud of that and proud of the work that we did after getting the initial report.
Thank you. Simon, do you want to kick this off?
Thank you. Good morning, auditor and committee members. My name is Simon Vakili. I was the lead auditor for the fleet management follow-up we're presenting this morning. I'm joined at the table by Sean Jones, senior auditor. Jennifer Lim, audit manager, and senior auditor Natalia Kielinski also contributed to the project, but could not attend today. I'd like to extend my thanks on behalf of the team, staff, and the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure. It was a pleasure to work with you again. Described in the original audit report, the Fleet Management Division oversees and maintains the vehicles and equipment belonging to 43 city agencies. While these agencies operate and are responsible for safeguarding their own vehicles, Fleet Management manages every other aspect of the fleet. The objective of our original audit was to determine whether the Fleet Management Division was adequately managing and overseeing the city's fleet. This included evaluating the fleet's funding structure, assessing performance against goals established by management, and assessing controls over assets. The original audit covered the period from January 1st, 2022 through March 31st, 2024. Our original audit, released in October 24, had three findings. The first was that the fleet's funding structure resulted in the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure paying for other agencies' fuel and maintenance costs. The second was that the city was not meeting its targets for vehicle use, availability, and fleet replacement. And finally, that inadequate controls created risk of waste and abuse. We made 13 recommendations in our original report as shown on the actions since audit report page of the follow-up. The division fully implemented 7 and partially implemented 4. The division did not implement 2 of the recommendations. So before we get into specifics, I'd like to open the floor for any questions or comments from agency or audit committee members.
I don't see any questions. Let's continue.
Okay, so I'll discuss finding 1. Beginning on page 1 of the report, first finding says the fleet funding structure results in transportation and infrastructure paying for other agencies' fuel and maintenance costs. Our recommendation was to reevaluate the funding structure and update city ordinance to reflect that funding structure. After our review of documentation, we found the division partially implemented this recommendation. We found the division evaluated the city's current funding model for fleet management services and compared it to other options. It decided to stay with the current model, where transportation and infrastructure is responsible for the cost of fleet maintenance, regardless of which agency owns the vehicle. Division personnel told us this was to focus their available resources on operational improvements before an administrative change they felt would be less impactful. However, the ordinance has not been updated and still identifies fleet management as an internal service fund. Because the ordinance still does not reflect the city's current approach to funding fleet management services, we consider this recommendation partially implemented. So we'll pause here for any questions and comments from agency and committee members on finding one.
Any further comments?
Well, we do exist as an internal funding or internal service fund for our enterprise funds. So it's both. We do continue to serve that way for divisions like wastewater and others that are full enterprises. So they do pay for their service.
I know we have a few vehicles at the airport, and we don't get charged.
By the airport?
No, by your internal service fund.
You're on the general fund.
I know that, but so you have this mixture of...
Well, right now, so we submitted a memo, and I think that's why we got partial credit here. We did work with the Department of Finance to evaluate the funding structure, and I think we're still in that evaluation period. Right now, the city's general fund is in a tough way. And if we were to spread those costs to the other general fund divisions, that wouldn't improve things overnight. That's just moving deck chairs on the Titanic. So we are evaluating what that looks like right now and doing a better job of communicating, working towards doing a better job of communicating to those departments what their spend is. Because right now, it's completely not transparent. So that feels like a blank check. But in being able to communicate better to them on what their repair costs are, what their fuel costs are, what their parts costs are, and asking them to be more conscious of those costs, especially with fuel, right? Not taking trips when they don't need to, because fuel this year is quite volatile. And our projections are now over what our original projections were due to economic forces. So we've not done that in the past. So it's truly not a full ISF for those general fund. We're not there yet. That's absolutely true. I don't think that's coming in the next year or two. But we are taking steps to make sure that those departments and agencies understand their spend and understand their constraints and what we budgeted them for.
So possibly in the future.
Never say never.
All right. Simon?
Thank you. Sean will now discuss finding two.
Thanks, Simon. Beginning on page 3 of the report, the second finding says the city is not meeting its targets for vehicle use, availability, and fleet replacement. As shown on page 3 of the report, the division fully implemented 3 of the recommendations related to gaining authority for the city's vehicle fleet, optimizing vehicle usage, and creating a plan for vehicle replacements, and partially implemented 2 of the recommendations related to developing plans for meeting vehicle availability goals and addressing staffing needs. We found the division worked with the mayor's office to receive operational authority and now has the ability to review vehicle usage across agencies and effectively manage vehicle allocations. We also found the division established policies and procedures for evaluating vehicle usage across city agencies by conducting quarterly data reviews and assessing the operational needs of agencies, which helps the city identify underused assets and better align fleet inventory with operational needs. The division also updated its policies and procedures and collaborated with city agencies to identify which vehicles needed to be replaced. By establishing a clear plan for vehicle replacements, the city can ensure agencies have reliable vehicles while saving taxpayers money on costly repairs. Recommendation 2.4 was partially implemented. We found the division met with stakeholders to discuss a plan for right-sizing the city's fleet to help reach its 95% availability goal by removing underused vehicles, replacing older vehicles to minimize downtime and replacement costs, and outsourcing preventative maintenance. However, because the plan was never formally documented, the division risks wasting resources and may struggle to provide essential services that the public relies on. Recommendation 2.5 was partially implemented as well. Although the division has not finalized a formal staffing plan, they have leveraged outsourcing for preventative maintenance and specialized repairs, which has helped reduce the maintenance backlogs and increase the number of vehicles available for use. However, without a formal staffing plan in place, it can be difficult for the city to determine whether it has the right staffing levels to support the fleet's operations. I would now like to open the floor for any questions and comments before I present finding three.
Any additional comments from the department?
I don't think anything substantive. We are in a much better place from a staffing perspective than we were last year. We are actually hiring, so we are maximizing every open position that we have that is funded. We don't have as many funded positions as we could use, and that's just the reality of where we're at. I think all the things that Sean mentioned are contributing towards our plan to maximize what we've got and contribute every resource and every ounce of energy that we have towards our availability numbers. Our adjusted availability goal is 87%, and right now, overall, on average, we're at 86. And it's a true testament to the teams, but behind that is a lot of overtime and a lot of work and a lot of creative thinking and moving vehicles around. So we don't have a documented plan in the way that I think the audit team wanted to see, but we have 100 SOPs that have been written that guide what we do, and then that's how we operate. So I do think that the infrastructure is there. It's the funding and the replacement cycle that's a challenge.
Great. Thank you. Any questions from John?
Finding three, beginning on page 8 of the report, that inadequate controls create a risk of waste and abuse. The finding has 7 recommendations for the division. After a review of documentation and discussions with agency personnel, we found that 4 recommendations were fully implemented. These were: comply with the parts service level agreement, create policies and procedures for outsourced labor, review, identify, and correct inaccurate data in AssetWorks, and improve the functionality of the AssetWorks software. One recommendation to design and document a comprehensive fuel activity review was partially implemented, and 2 other recommendations to remove unauthorized users from the driver database and to conduct a physical security assessment were not implemented. The Fleet Management Division developed a new fuel use policy that addressed user access and procedures for reconciling active users in the fuel system. However, guidance did not include several elements included in the recommendation, including criteria for identifying abnormal transactions, procedures for following up on abnormal transactions, criteria for appropriate use of override codes, and requirements for preserving override transaction history. The risk remains that without standardized and comprehensive procedures for reviewing fuel usage, the Fleet Management Division may fail to detect unusual activity. The division also developed a procedure to keep the authorized fuel user list updated. However, when we compared the authorized user list to city termination reports, we found approximately 1,500 of the 8,500 authorized users were no longer employed by the city. Because fleet management did not implement its policy to remove former city employees from the authorized driver list, the city still risks former employees accessing the city's fuel. The division installed a badge reader in one of its buildings to improve tracking and security, but has not performed a comprehensive assessment of the other 6 locations where parts are stored. As such, the division may remain unaware of risks related to vehicle parts stored in city facilities. We found that the division added inventory management to supervisors' performance goals, which helps improve accountability over parts stored in stock rooms. New policy and procedures for outsourcing, which took effect in January 2025, were also implemented and covered all the elements we originally suggested. By documenting these decisions and performing a cost-benefit analysis, the division is now in a much better position to ensure that outsourcing is both strategic and cost-effective for the city. Inaccurate data within AssetWorks, the division's asset management system, was identified and corrected, strengthening the division's ability to track and manage preventative maintenance. Finally, by continuing to work with the city's technology services and their vendor, the software implementation has been completed and communication with other agencies has improved through automated notifications for repairs and maintenance and city-facing dashboards for financial information and vehicle availability. This concludes our presentation of the Fleet Management Follow-Up Report. I would like to open the floor for any questions or comments from the agency and Audit Committee members.
And this is where we wanted to make a quick note. Y'all frame it and then I'll throw it over to you. So some of this ran into a timing issue when the report, the follow-up report was being drafted and as we were finishing up some of our work. So for 3-1 and 3-2, we're really happy to report. And we did share this with the team and they were just up against a wall with things that had already been printed. Those are implemented and wanted to toss it over to Brad to give those details.
Yeah, just wanted to make sure it was noted that those did get implemented. Obviously outside of the testing period and the draft window period, but communications and documents that we provided prior to today's meeting, I think should get us credit or at least the notification that we did implement 3-1 and 3-2. 3-1 was implemented fully 4/29, so just very recently, and then 3-2 was on 3/30. So just wanted to make that note while we were had the opportunity to present today.
And that includes a full workday integration, so as employees are terminated from the system, they're also terminated from that fuel access.
How about the physical security recommendation?
Not quite there. Did install the badge access, but it's not as far as we'd like to go. It's a fairly porous building. It's difficult in the way that when the bays are all open, right, there's a lot of ways to get into that building. So there's some more work and more investment that needs to be done there. Anything to add?
No, I don't think that's accurate.
Well, I would, yeah, go ahead, Frank.
I'm just curious, you mentioned earlier about fuel costs. Where is the city's fleet in regards to some of the climate goals that CASR set out with vehicles that run on other than gasoline and diesel, and how does that fit in? I know it's not part of the audit program, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, ongoing. CASR is a very close partner with us, and thankfully they do have some additional funds. As we work through the fleet replacement cycle every year, we identify the vehicles that can be replaced in electric. That may be because that vehicle type is available. That's a lot easier for light-duty vehicles than it is for specialty or heavy-duty vehicles. But even in that regard, we are testing and moving forward. We tested a couple of electric sweepers last year. We own one. It's not great. It doesn't perform to the standard that we need it to when working 10-hour shifts. But they are getting better. And same on the refuse vehicle side. We just got our first rear loader last year, and that is in service right now, and we are looking to contract 6 ASLs, which are the assisted side loaders with a side arm, next year to hopefully get them next year. We'll see.
And we do have 2 additional rear loaders that are going to be delivered by end of year, too.
And a stake bed truck that's coming next week.
And a stake bed truck that should be here probably within the next week or two.
We're starting to get into that heavy duty and testing those, but those we've seen to be fairly proven, and we're excited to try them out. And we're working with CASR on the infrastructure side, too, which is the other piece of the formula that has to be there in time and operational for those vehicles to be charged and work.
Jack? I have a personal curious question. It may be wrong, but, you know, I've observed, you know, the refuse trucks used to be owned by the city. And then as I was riding my bike around town, I noticed there were a lot of leased vehicles. This was at least up to 6 months ago. I was just curious why you would lease vehicles as opposed to own them. And this is my own question, and it may be a worthless one.
Yeah. Some of it is necessity and some of it is experiment. We have a very delayed replacement cycle on ASLs. More than half of them are past their useful life, and more than that percentage are nearing their use at the end of their useful life. So they're not performing well. We have a number of vehicles that are down, and it's funding constraints that keep us from bringing those back up. So we are trying out renting vehicles, which are guaranteed to be there. If you were to take the life of a vehicle, it's a little bit more expensive, but we're guaranteed to have a vehicle in its first couple of years hours of life. So they are very reliable. So we're testing what the benefits of that are to have a fleet that we're not maintaining and that at least extensively, it's still under warranty in a lot of cases. And so seeing if the additional cost is worth having the extra reliability for that program. But we only have 12?
There's 12 ASLs right and two rear loaders and three rear loaders.
Yeah.
I think it's at least 14, 15 units.
Yeah. And there's more
just,
than 100.
They all just happen to be in East Denver, so I see.
Yeah. They do try and condense them, but we have over 100 vehicles that are required for that weekly service, right? So it's a pretty small percentage.
Any other questions, comments?
I will talk about fleet all day long. It's such an essential part of how the city delivers all of its services.
Well, I would say congratulations on a very good follow-up audit report. A job well done.
Thank you.
We have a great team. So.
And you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the time.
All right. We have another follow-up report on city shelters.
The manager on the city shelters follow-up representing this morning. Other team members are Jules Mann, lead auditor, senior auditors Danny Pluitt and Jordan Monk, and associate auditor Caroline Nelson.
And Amy?
Hello. Director of Finance for the Department of Housing Stability.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Any opening comments before we get started?
No, I was trying to check on my team members. I'm running a little bit late, but we can definitely go in reverse order if you'd like. I am in charge of most of the operations tasks that are recommended, so we can start there.
Can we do that?
Sure. Should we do the background first?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll just start out with background.
As we described in the original audit report, Denver's homelessness shelter system plays a critical role in addressing homelessness. Shelters range from shared space lodgings to individual rooms and tiny home market communities. The traditional day and overnight shelters, known as congregate shelters, house people in large common spaces. Non-congregate shelters house individuals, roommates, or families in single rooms, such as hotel rooms, while micro-communities use quick-to-build structures like tiny houses to temporarily house people experiencing homelessness. The city also provides cold weather shelters for people experiencing homelessness under certain weather conditions. In Denver, shelters can be city-owned, city-leased, or privately owned. At the time of our audit in late 2024, 13 shelters were privately owned, while 12 were owned or leased by the city, but operated by a nonprofit organization that contracted with the city. The Department of Housing Stability was created in 2019. Soon thereafter, a number of events impacted the department and the shelter system in Denver, including the worldwide COVID-19 pandemic. In December 2022, Denver experienced a significant increase in the number of migrants arriving in the city. This led to the activation of the city's Emergency Operations Center and required the department to assist Denver Human Services and monitor whether migrants enter the traditional shelter system after leaving emergency shelters. In July of 2023, The new mayor was sworn in, and a new mayoral priority of reducing the number of people experiencing unsheltered homelessness led to an emergency declaration focused on bringing 1,000 people indoors from homeless encampments. The next year, the mayor set a new goal called All a Mile High to increase the number of people brought indoors to 2,000 by the end of 2024. As shown on the follow-ups report highlights page, our main audit objective was to assess the extent to which the Department of Housing Stability maintained an effective system for monitoring shelter provider performance and spending. This included three sub-objectives that focused on the department's contact monitoring procedures and practices, shelter provider contract compliance with city rules, and whether the department's invoicing policies and procedures were compliant with applicable rules. We also researched and described recent emergencies, organizational changes, and staffing challenges that impacted the department before and during our audit. The original audit scope focused on the efficiency and effectiveness of the city system for sheltering people experiencing homelessness. We did not include the emergency shelters set up to temporarily house the large numbers of migrants arriving in the city starting in late 2022, as this was managed by a different agency, which was Denver Human Services. The time period associated with our review was January 2022 through March 31st, 2024. In our audit of city shelters from November 2024, we had three findings. The first finding discussed that the department did not adequately ensure safety and compliance with non-discrimination rules at shelters. Specifically, some shelters' anti-discrimination policies were not sufficient, and shelter guests may not have had a clear and established method of filing complaints with shelters. The second finding said the department's approach for monitoring shelter provider spending was not effective. For example, the department was not tracking overall shelter-related expenses. Finally, the department was not properly restricting access to sensitive information on its shared drive. We found city employees not working for the department had access to a shared drive folder containing sensitive information. We made 15 recommendations on our audit report, as discussed on the Actions Since Audit Report page. The department partially implemented 5 recommendations and did not implement 9 others. The department disagreed with 1 recommendation from the original audit. I will now pause for questions or comments from audit committee members or representatives.
Welcome.
Cool. All right. Sorry, we were not trying to stand you up, but the invite from your calendar did start at 9:30, so I apologize for that.
Well, you're still welcome. So.
Thank you.
We just got started with the background from the original report. Do you have anything you'd want to open with?
Sure. So I'm Cole Chandler, Executive Director of the Department of Housing Stability. I'll let Jeff introduce himself in just a moment. I just want to say that we're really proud of the work that HOST has done over the years. Just yesterday at this time, we were standing on a sidewalk with a bunch of our friends celebrating all the work that we've done around reducing homelessness. Hopefully you saw that we're at now a 64% reduction in unsheltered homelessness since 2023. And last year, for the first time in over 9 years, we have a reduction in overall homelessness of 12.5%. Obviously, what's highlighted in this audit is, the most serious thing to us, which is the safety of our guests. And also the way that we manage our finances. I'm actually quite proud of the way that the team has taken those things on to increase safety and security at our shelters. And I think that we're making lots of progress in the ways that we're managing our finances, and we'll seek to continue to be more accountable with those and transparent with those in the years ahead. And so, once again, thank you for taking a deep dive and looking under the hood with us to help us improve the system that we think is really world class that we're building. So thanks for having us.
Okay. Jeff?
Good morning. Jeff Kosicki. I'm a deputy director at HOST.
All right. I think we can start with recommendation 1.
The first finding, beginning on page 1 of the report, was that the Department of Housing Stability does not adequately ensure safety and compliance with non-discrimination rules at shelters. This finding had 5 recommendations. After our review of documentation and statements from the department, we found the department partially implemented three recommendations: develop policies and procedures on shelter security monitoring, require grievance policies and reporting processes, develop non-discrimination and grievance monitoring policies and procedures. The department did not implement two recommendations: to develop a shelter security needs assessment and to work with shelter providers to update policies. As we described in the original audit, we found required security measures at the All in Mile High shelter, the Aspen, had not been implemented by the shelter provider several months after the contract began. Two people were shot and killed inside the shelter during that period when some security measures were not yet in place. By not implementing recommendation 1.1, the risk remains that security measures may not be in place timely when a shelter first starts operating because the department did not develop a shelter safety and security needs assessment. The assessment was intended to be a tool the department could use in contract negotiations with shelter providers to ensure all parties would be informed of and on the same page about the type of security needed when new shelters were being opened and the cost of the security measures. Instead of going through this process, the department created a shelter safety and security plan template they give to shelter providers to help guide their creation of security plans, which are required to be submitted to the department within 90 days of the contract starting. However, the template does not accomplish the same goal as the security needs assessment because it does not include requirements for determining security measures like the number of security guards, number of cameras, or the cost of those measures. We also reviewed a sample of shelter provider security plans against the department's security plan template and found that only two of the five plans addressed all required topics from the template. Therefore, the department is also not ensuring shelter providers consistently incorporate all elements from the template in their shelter safety and security plans. For recommendation 1.2 that was partially implemented, the department created policies and procedures that identify the staff responsible for monitoring security plans and establish an escalation process to department leaders if problems are not addressed. However, the policies do not outline timeline expectations for when security measures should be implemented by, and we found that monitoring practices were inconsistent. This contributes to the remaining risk that providers may not have security measures in place in a timely manner. Regarding recommendations 1.3 and 1.4 that the department partially implemented, we found that the department updated its scope of work to require shelter providers to develop and submit grievance policies, and the department created standards outlining what should be included in those grievance policies. They also determined the staff responsible for collecting and reviewing the policies. However, because there is no requirement for grievance policies to apply to guests, not just employees, there is still a risk that shelter providers' grievance policies do not provide shelter guests with ways to report complaints or provide feedback. While the department developed grievance monitoring policies and procedures, this guidance does not state how often reviews of shelter provider grievance policies should occur. Also, the department did not create policies for non-discrimination monitoring, so the risk remains that shelter guests and employees could face discrimination without an effective method for submitting complaints. By not implementing recommendation 1.5, the risk remains that people served in city shelters might not be protected from discrimination or aware of the grievance process available to them. As discussed on page 6 of the follow-up report, while the department created standards for the content of shelter provider grievance policies, we found that none of the grievance policies we reviewed included several of the department's standards, including information on prohibited actions or behavior, a conflict resolution process, and a detailed appeals process. The department standards also say that shelter providers must post a notice on how clients can file a discrimination complaint, but none of the shelter provider policies we reviewed mention non-discrimination complaint notice requirements or processes as described in the recommendation. I would now like to open up the floor for questions and comments from the audit committee and the department.
So, Cole, that covers a lot of ground about security for your guests. Would you like to tell us a little more?
Yeah, Jeff, would you like to?
Yes, thank you very much. First of all, just want to thank the team for the audit. When it was done, I was relatively new to the city, and it provided an excellent roadmap for areas that clearly needed improvement around security and around how grievances were handled. I think we appreciated, as Cole said, to kind of look under the hood and agreed with the recommendations. And we believe we largely did implement them, maybe not to the letter, but certainly the spirit of them. And I'd like to present some evidence of the improved security after I sort of explain how we approach this and where I think that we're at. We did indeed create the security plan template that is required for all of our shelter providers. In the creation of that, the expectation is that they are doing their own needs assessment of what's happening as far as security at the site. And in our approval process, the plan is designed so for us to be able to see their own assessment and make our recommendation as to whether or not the plan should be approved. Most of them were upon first draft, some were not, and we had a back and forth to make sure that we had, we felt they were implementing the plan in order to make the building safer. We have received and have approved all security plans from all city-funded shelters, both those that we own and those that the city does not own. I think there are some, I mean, I don't want to get into like a, this is what it said and, you know, we, this is what we said, but I think it's important to note that our security is a lot more than just how many security guards are at a site. And in fact, some of our providers don't use security guards. They provide their own security. Things, you know, having run shelters for most of my career will tell you culture, how you treat your guests, the services that are being provided are way more important than having security guards and the building of community are way more important than having security guards and metal detectors at the sites, frankly. And we also trust our providers all have different ways. Some do want to have security guards, and that's okay. Others don't, as long as we know what they're doing makes sense. For example, you've probably read in the newspaper, one of our providers has staff on every single floor of the shelter now and are letting people into their units to provide an extra level of security and safety. We have worked really carefully and closely with our program officers, have worked really closely with all of our providers on security. We also do we have quarterly visits, quarterly reports that are provided by our shelter providers. They're also required to submit critical incident reports, and we do annual monitoring visits. In preparation for this, I went back and checked to see, you know, of our 25 or so shelters, were all the monitoring visits done, were all the quarterly visits done, and there was one quarterly visit at one micro community that was missing. So for the most part, we are out at the shelters, physically there, monitoring what's going on. There are questions about security. The forum doesn't specifically reference the plan, which, you know, it probably should, but it is occurring. We've also made some major changes to our RFP process, in which we have made sure that past performance around issues related to security and operations are very highly scored in the selection of new providers. And as a result, we've seen three new providers come into our shelter system as a result of, you know, performance that we weren't happy with our older providers. And we've done, you know, many, many things to make our contracting and our security and our monitoring plans better. And I think what's really important is, were we successful? And so far to date, I think we've been incredibly successful. There's been a 40% decrease in 911 calls to the Aspen, which has been the major, I think, it's gotten a lot of publicity and there's been a lot of security challenges. Overall, it's still new. We only have had this in place since January, but we're seeing an 11% reduction in the whole system in 911 calls to the sites, which we're really happy about. We are seeing a reduction in the critical incident reports that we're receiving. And last year, we did have two, I would call, major security issues, again, at the Aspen. I would say none of them had to do, they had more to do with staff frankly, acting out of line with one of our providers. That provider is no longer operating that shelter, largely as a result of those sorts of occurrences. But they weren't related to a security guard. They're not doing their job. So there's always going to be more work to do. We're always trying to get better. I think we are getting better every day. But I believe that we certainly honored and embraced the spirit of what the audit said. You know, we may not have dotted every I or crossed every T, but I think our subject matter experts at HOST, almost all of my program officers have worked at or run shelters in the past, but we're the ones who really guided how we decided to proceed with making our shelter safer. I could talk about grievances, but I've been talking a lot, so maybe I should pause.
I just have one question. I'm just sitting here and listening to what is being said by the auditors and what you've said, and it kind of goes like this. And they seem to be saying there's still a lot of things, that there are a lot of things that haven't been done. And you're saying that a lot of things have been done. And all I'm trying to understand is, from the auditor's point of view, am I misunderstanding something, or is there a difference? Emily, is that a fair question?
Yeah, I can jump in here. I think, you know, big picture, as you can see through those five recommendations, three of them we said partially implemented. There's been a good deal of work happening around the security plan templates, getting shelter providers to submit those. And I think that's evident and showing up in the fact that we're saying these are partially implemented. They've made good progress there. With 1.1, that recommendation about a safety and security needs assessment, I think there's a disconnect there. During the audit, that recommendation came specifically out of the disconnect between Salvation Army and the city when they were establishing that shelter, that it was up and running and security was not in place for months in. And there was a difference of opinion of the cost of security at that time. So what we were trying to do with recommendation 1.1 is to make sure HOST does some homework on the front end about this is our inventory of shelters, building types, security measures that could potentially need to be in place, whether that's surveillance cameras, guards, other things you got. Take inventory of all that, the potential costs of those, so that the next time you're entering into a contract with a new shelter provider, like what was happening with On Mile High and House 1000, that you're in a better position, HOST, to know exactly what requirements are probably going to be needed. And so both parties, when you're establishing that agreement, are on the same page, because that just didn't happen with House 1000 and that particular contract. So that's what we were trying to nudge HOST toward, doing that work to be in a good position were that to happen again. And I think that didn't necessarily happen, which is why 1.1 is not implemented. They went a different route, which is the security plans, having shelter providers provide those to HOST for review. But it's a different ask than what we were after with 1.1. But they've certainly done a good deal of work, and I think that shows up in the partially implemented for 1.2 and 1.4 and what we tried to describe in the report. I hope that helps.
And I would add, I think we gave you a significant to-do list with the initial report. Mm-hmm. And you've made a lot of progress, so thank you.
Thank you.
Should we continue?
Jordan will now present the recommendations for finding two.
Finding two, page 8 of the report, says the Department of Housing and Stability's current approach monitoring shelter provider spending is not effective. We made 7 recommendations to address this finding. We currently agree with all but one. Recommendation 2.7, spending new costs related to policy. After our review of the other 6 recommendations, we found that we partially implemented recommendation 2.2, developed comprehensive procedures, and did not implement the remaining 5 recommendations to routinely track all shelter-related expenses, update invoicing procedures, review shelter provider invoice submission guidelines, conduct a staffing analysis, and recruit staff to fill vacancies. Beginning on page 9 of the report, while the department partially addressed recommendation 2.2 by drafting new policies that aid staff, including some invoice processing and review procedures, policies remain decentralized and lack guidance on how to address issues. We also learned the policies exist in a draft state pending contracting changes later this year. Additionally, the policies did not include clear guidance for the amount of supporting documentation that should be uploaded to Workday, and shelter provider invoice guidelines were not updated to reflect best practices. By partially implementing Recommendation 2.2 and not implementing 2.1 through 2.4, the Department of Housing Stability cannot ensure staff are tracking shelter-specific costs, whether funds are being used appropriately, or that spending is documented in accordance with city fiscal rules. As such, the risk remains the department cannot hold shelter providers accountable for the use of taxpayer money. Furthermore, the lack of sufficient policies and procedures risk staff's inability to effectively perform their work duties and an eventual loss of institutional knowledge during staff turnover. Looking at page 12 of the report, these risks may be further exacerbated by the department's current staffing situation. However, because no analysis or hiring plan was provided, we were unable to determine the impact of current staffing levels on housing stability oversight of shelter provider spending. By not implementing recommendations 2.5 and 2.6, the department cannot know whether it has enough staff to process and review shelter invoice documentation. Ultimately, the risk remains that housing stability is unable to hold providers accountable for their spending requirements. I'll now open the floor for any questions or comments before Caroline begins with finding three.
Comments on all those?
Absolutely. thank you for the audit report and some of the things. I just wanted to obviously talk about some of the context that we've had at Host over the last several months. I mean, as everyone is aware, we've had a lot of turnover, not just on our accounts payable team, but also at the level. So there's a lot of things that are kind of in a holding pattern in terms of getting implemented. I think the biggest thing I just want to make like crystal clear is that we do track each and every dollar that comes into Host and where it goes and who receives those funds. The way in which those dollars are tracked may be at some discussion, but we are in the final processes of finalizing our policy in regards to work tags and recommendation 2.1, and hopefully we'll have that finalized like mid-June. It's been reviewed by our executive leadership team, and really happy that we've made a lot of headway in that regard. Also, in regard to the invoicing procedure, I do believe that the audit report had documented that there was communications with the fiscal agents on all of our shelter providers in regarding to what needed to be submitted for their invoicing and how that would be, and hadn't been translated to all of the universal documents that we have yet, but obviously in regard to the staffing analysis in our current situation, like we have to prioritize, you know, making sure our providers are paid timely so that they can serve the public, and then we try to, you know, come back and do all the administrative things to kind of tie up all the loose nuts and bolts that we have laying around because of the various vacancies that we have in the department. But super happy about how much progress that we've made in the last 5 years, considering we had no work tags at all when we started this agency in 2020. So I think we've done a really good job at moving forward, and we're looking to try to hire as soon as we can, but with the current economic climate, it's just probably not a possibility at this time to really make our staff as robust as it needs to be with the budget that we're responsible for. But you know, our team is doing the best they can to get all of those things completed, so we'll continue to march forward and do what we can with the folks that we have.
And I would just add that with the limited hiring that we are able to do, we are prioritizing finance and contract positions. So if anybody wants to come help out.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll take it.
Lori?
So apart from, or in addition to the recommendations here, which are more detailed and process-oriented, is there a means by which you evaluate on a higher level after all of the expenses have, you know, trickled up, providers against each other or against a standard that you all have established as far as cost per guest or cost per, and there's other soft things I know that, you know, go into an evaluation, not just cost, safety and other things, but is there a method by which you evaluate the providers that way?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. You want to talk about
Sure.
performance-based?
Yeah, well, I think there's regardless of whether it's a performance-based contract or a cost reimbursement contract, we do look at exactly what you said, the cost per guest per night is the, you know, cost per bed per night, and essentially look for anomalies in the system, like is somebody getting way more than everybody else? If so, why?
Does it vary a lot?
Not anymore. We've corrected that over the past 2 years. As we've done this analysis, we've made sure that providers are all within a range of per bed per night range. Based on the type of shelter, we look at adult congregate shelter, family shelter, adult non-congregate shelter, youth shelter. They all have different costs, but and then some of our shelters, just two, are overnight only, so it's a very different product that we're providing to the guests. But yeah, we've gotten that much more in alignment than it had been.
Thank you.
So that kind of relates to the recommendation, you know, that you didn't agree with, which is 2.7. And I mean, I think the concern I had with this in the original audit is that you were getting invoices that were 200-400 pages long of all sorts of detail. And now you talk about exactly what I had talked to the previous executive director about is more of a daily rate. And each shelter could have a different daily rate, but they should be within somewhat of a reasonable range. Are you looking at that or?
Yes, and I appreciate the question and appreciate the opportunity to talk about something that we're all really proud of at Host, is that we are moving towards a performance-based contracting model. Mm-hmm. We piloted it with 7 shelters. I didn't want to declare success until a year, but my staff were very sure and very correct that it has been incredibly successful. So we are now expanding it to some of our other shelters. And it not only, I think, is a more efficient way of managing the funds, it's also kind of changing the culture at Host and with our providers and what we focus on. Because when you get a 75-page invoice as a program officer and your job is to review that invoice, that's what you're going to be doing, for a good part of the week when you get a bunch of invoices on your desk. Now what we are doing is we are paying for performance. So for example, providers are paid under 4 metrics right now, and we're still, again, piloting this. One is what I would call heads in beds. How many people, how many bed nights? So you're paid a dollar amount for each bed night. You get paid for what's called rapid resolution, which is a best practice in shelter that we felt wasn't being done enough, but now it is, which is when someone comes into the shelter, your job as a case manager is to try to get them out of the shelter by starting with the question, where was the last safe place that you lived and how can we help get you back there? We're seeing now 95% of new guests are having a rapid resolution discussion. We expect now weekly case management provision that's housing focused. And then we also are expecting that every client in the building has had what's called a one-home assessment. A one-home assessment is required if you're going to get housing through what we call a coordinated entry system. It's really critical. Just one anecdote, or it's not an anecdote, it's data. When we started this project, only 35% of our shelter guests had active in the community queue housing assessments that were active. In what's called the community queue, we're now at over 90% within a week. That got corrected within one quarter. Our focus, we also found many, many challenges which with the HMIS, or the Homelessness Management Information System, that people are required to, our providers are required to use. But now that their payment is tied to effective and clear data entry in that system, data quality is at like 95%. We do a data quality test. So we have took that to heart and have piloted this model and are now looking at, we are going to do it at 5 more shelters in 2027. Our providers were very skeptical at first. They are now thrilled and asking us to do this at all of the sites. And our monitoring now is, you know, very focused on why are you not meeting your outcomes, or why are you doing such a great job? How can we teach other providers, as opposed to digging in on invoices. We, of course, also have put in place monitoring controls so that we can make sure the funds are being used appropriately and within accordance with city policies and procedures, but not focusing on the production of 75-page invoices. The payment is driven by a dashboard that we control. We are gathering the data from the HMIS system, checking it. The providers can verify it if they want. If there's discrepancies, which there's been few, we work on correcting them. Like, no, I did that case management meeting on that day, and okay, well, you didn't enter it right. So, it's going very, very well, and I think it's really changed the way our program officers are doing their jobs. They have more time to focus on things like security and grievance procedures and outcomes than invoices.
Thank you. That's a great answer.
Sounds like
any other questions from the committee? Recommendation number three. Finding number three.
That's me.
Okay.
There was another one.
Beginning on page 15 of the report, finding three states the Department of Housing Stability is not properly restricting access to sensitive information on its shared drive. This finding had three recommendations. As shown here, and on pages 15 through 17 of the report, Housing Stability did not implement two of the recommendations about creating policies and procedures and a quality assurance review for protecting sensitive information. The department partially implemented one recommendation about securing file access permissions. By not implementing recommendations 3.1 and 3.2, the department cannot ensure it is consistently protecting sensitive information and following city rules. The department does not currently have comprehensive, centralized invoicing procedures with guidance for handling sensitive information, as directed by recommendation 3.1. The department gave us documents that were either in draft form or outdated. Further, department leaders told us that guidance for personally identifiable information would be incorporated when invoice policies and procedures are updated in 2026. Also, the department did not provide us with evidence of a documented and ongoing process to review invoice documents to ensure procedures established in response to recommendation 3.1 are followed. To determine if personally identifiable information was redacted, we reviewed a sample of 13 invoices from 2025. We found 5 of the 13 invoices contained sensitive information. As a result, the risk remains that shelter guest and other sensitive information is not redacted from invoices and supporting documentation uploaded to Workday, which could lead to negative consequences for shelter users and providers if this information leaks. To respond to recommendation 3.3, the department moved its filing structure to Microsoft Teams. As a result, some files are only accessible to certain Microsoft Teams groups that only have access to specific files, and some files are locked to certain members of each group. This effort mitigates the risk that files are accessible to those without a demonstrated need. However, even though the department took the necessary steps to secure its files, it did not provide us with evidence of a process to regularly review the file structure and permissions going forward, and they have not formally documented roles and responsibilities for records coordinators. Therefore, the risk remains that the department cannot ensure shelter guest and shelter provider information is protected without a process for the regular review of file access permissions and expectations for those carrying out the reviews. This concludes our presentation of the City Shelters follow-up report. I would like to open up the floor for questions and comments from agency and audit committee members.
Any comments on finding number three?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, although this is not squarely within the financial realm, you know, losing our deputy director of operations during this process has definitely put on pause some of the recommendations that we have here. I know that we will partially implement some of the recommendations as part of the overall structure in the invoicing policy when it comes specifically to the personally identifiable information that the partners submit to us in order to both be, you know, administratively unburdensome as much as possible and also protecting the shelter guests. And then, you know, ancillary to that, we will continue to review the file structure on Teams and the roles and responsibilities for those that are responsible for maintaining those file structures, reviewing them regularly, and making sure that we have ongoing communication with the partners about submission of PII to make sure that obviously our very low staff doesn't have the opportunity to have to sit and redact hundreds of pages of information, as the auditor stated. We'll continue to work on that, and it is in process. I know it says early 2026, so we are a little bit behind, but still 2026, so I can win that we're ongoing with that process.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? I wanted to congratulate you and the scores of others that brought about the results of the point in time information that we got yesterday. So great work. And I also want to remember those who didn't survive homelessness, which includes one of my brothers. Thank you. All right, general business. We have our next committee meeting here Thursday, June 18th at 9 o'clock. I'd like to adjourn into executive session. Is there a motion to go into executive session?
I so move.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? We are in executive session.